Coleman versus Hardy. Mr. Michel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Brian Michael, a third-year law student from Notre Dame, appearing by leave of court under the supervision of Attorney Robert Palmer. I represent Petitioner Lawrence Coleman in this action. We respectfully ask this Court to reverse the decision of the District Court denying Mr. Coleman's petition for habeas corpus relief. This case comes to us today by way of a certificate of appealability issued by this Court, asking the parties to examine whether the state courts reasonably determined that Coleman did not request counsel either at his time of arrest or at any time during his 17-hour custodial interrogation. That determination was not reasonable, and the district court should be reversed. Coleman puts forth two grounds of relief supporting this argument. First, that when reviewing his direct appeal, the Illinois appellate court applied an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law by failing to analyze the factors that Coleman set forth in his appeal under the totality of the circumstances. And second,
well, I don't know. The court just believed the police, right?
The court did defer
he said
to.
He never asked for a lawyer. He said he did.
Correct. That was the determination made at the suppression hearing, based on the credibility finding.
How do you go behind that?
However, there were a large number of other circumstances that should have been evaluated when looking at all the circumstances surrounding his arrest and his interrogation. And there was ample evidence supporting the fact, supporting Coleman's claim to have requested counsel, whereas the testimony from Graziano, from the detective that interrogated him, was equivocal as to when he had spoken.
It still comes down to a question of credibility, doesn't it?
It does not, I don't believe, Your Honor, because here.
Isn't it a question of credibility?
The state court was.
One witness says one thing, one says another. Court believes one of them, not the other. It's not a question of credibility?
That would be a question of credibility. However, there were many other circumstances.
But on that one issue, it's a question of credibility. What else comes in that makes the credibility finding not worthwhile?
I don't actually believe that our argument rests on undermining the entire credibility determination. It rests on the fact that
I don't understand that. If the police were telling the truth, then he never asked for a lawyer.
The determination.
Probable it is that he did, right?
The determination of the trial court that Coleman did not request counsel was up for appeal, and those facts surrounding his interrogation should have been analyzed under the totality of the circumstances when reviewing all of that, including that credibility determination. Here we had facts that showed that an undisputed call that Lawrence Coleman had phoned his attorney immediately after learning that he was wanted for police questioning in regards to a homicide. Several hours after that, he was taken into custody, and his attorney phoned the police station within several hours after that. That fact was affirmed in an affidavit by his attorney and was denied in equivocal terms by Graziano, where he could not recall the exact day that he had spoken with Attorney Weiner, but he knew that it was just not that if he did talk to him, it wasn't about Coleman. It was about another defendant in the case. And in addition to that fact, the state court believed that the testimony of the assistant state's attorney, ASA Nazarian, also corroborated Graziano's testimony. However, she was not present for the first 12 to 14 hours of that interrogation, so her testimony could not possibly corroborate what happened during that time. The only officer who could have corroborated that testimony was Detective Lynch. And Detective Lynch was conspicuously absent from appearing at the suppression hearing. He did not testify at trial. His signatures, only his signature and not that of Graziano, is present on the court-reported statement.
No, corroboration isn't required.
Excuse me?
Corroboration isn't required.
No, but I'm saying that by the state court relying on the corroboration of a witness who is not even present for the first 12 hours, that was an unreasonable, that was unreasonable in itself. Combined with the additional factors that Coleman was never allowed to use the telephone during his interrogation, a fact which the state court on appeal did not consider in its determination, and how the
does the appeal court refer to the this corroboration that you're challenging?
Yes, because the state court of the credibility determination at the trial level rested on the corroboration of Graziano's testimony by ASA Nazarian. How that corroboration could have happened when she wasn't present for the first 12 hours of interrogation, and how that testimony supports Graziano's claim that Coleman never requested counsel during those 12 hours is simply unable to be determined from those facts. In addition, the fact that Coleman called his attorney and had the foresight to use a criminal to seek out the assistance of a criminal attorney that he had used in the past. He was not a stranger to the criminal justice system. He had minor convictions in the past, so he knew the procedures that happened and knew the value of having counsel appointed, of having counsel represent him. He knew that fact when he called his attorney when he found out the police were looking for him. He knew that fact when he was being arrested. And the fact that he was questioned over multiple times over a 17-hour period indicates that he was not being cooperative and was, in fact, likely waiting for the assistance of his attorney, which he was unable to secure.
How was it verified that he called his lawyer, or called the lawyer?
He testified at the suppression hearing, and a phone record was submitted at that suppression hearing, which confirmed that he did, in fact, place a call to his attorney at approximately 7:20 the morning before his arrest. However, assuming that the attorney was not in his office at that time, it's most reasonable to assume that he left a message. Later on, the Jimmy Coleman's affidavit shows that that the attorney did call him at his house at about 11 or noon when he was being arrested, and then later called Area 2 Violent Crimes, which he submitted in his affidavit. Taking all those circumstances under the totality...
A lawyer can invoke a client's Miranda claim.
Correct, Your Honor. That was never the argument that Coleman put forth in his direct appeal, and that is not the argument that we pursue now. It's uncontested that a lawyer phoning a police station cannot invoke his defendant's right to counsel. However,
you're into your rebuttal.
Oh, well, to briefly conclude then, with that evidence, the fact of the attorney's Wiener's phone call should have been looked at under the totality of the circumstance in addition to the facts that I previously presented. So for those foregoing reasons, I respectfully ask this court to reverse the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Michael. Mr. Simpson?
May it please the Court, David Simpson from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Respondent Warden. Petitioner asserts that his confession was unconstitutionally admitted because he requested counsel during his custody and his interrogation. After seeing and hearing Petitioner testify at the suppression hearing, the State Trial Court found that Petitioner's assertion...
Well, the opponent said that the trial court made a critical error because it relied on corroboration of the police testimony that was not possible.
So what the trial court held is its exact language was that the credibility is resolved on behalf of the state. I find that the assistant state's attorney's Nazarian's testimony supports that of Detective Graziano. So I think it's fair to say that the trial court took into account the corroborative effect of the assistant state's attorney's testimony, and I think it's fair that it could give some corroborative effect to the assistant state's attorney's testimony because she was present for some of the interrogation. I don't think it's fair to say that that was the only reason behind the state court's credibility finding.
I'm not saying that's the only reason, but how much of the – this interrogation was 17 hours?
He was taken into custody at about 11:30 in the morning. His confession was court-reported confession was finished at about 4:30. The record doesn't indicate how long the interrogation went on.
4:30 in the afternoon.
Pardon me.
4:30 in the afternoon.
4:30 in the morning. 4:30 in the morning.
Presumably it wasn't 17 consecutive hours of questioning, but it was some.
Correct.
But it was protracted. So how much of the actual interrogation was she present for, this assistant state's attorney?
So she testified that she entered the interrogation room at about midnight. So she would have been present for the last 4 to 4.5 hours. And then just to clarify some of the other facts in the record regarding the nature of interrogation, Detective Graziano testified that he interrogated petitioner several times over that period, which would imply that this is not a case of continuous tag team interrogation. The other point just to make is that petitioner himself requested to have his confession reported by a court reporter. Assistant State's Attorney Nazarian testified that it took some time to find the court reporter in the middle of the night, and so at least some of that time between midnight and 4 a.m. was taken just trying to track down a court reporter who could take the confession.
That was the period when this Assistant State's Attorney was there?
Correct. But I think to focus, I think the
so
court
they
was...
they did find a court reporter.
Pardon me?
They found a court reporter.
They did find a court reporter, correct. They did find a court reporter. The court reporter apparently was at the station on an unrelated case, but had to wrap that up. And so at about 4 in the morning, the
he
court reporter was fine.
He or she got drafted.
Right, exactly. Would have been a long night. But I think just to refocus to focus exactly on what the question is at issue, the state court did make a credibility determination, and those determinations are extraordinarily difficult to overturn on habeas. Under 2254E1, the state court's factual findings are presumed to be correct, and petitioner bears the burden of rebutting them by clear and convincing evidence. So in other words, petitioner cannot win this case unless he can show by clear and convincing evidence that he did request counsel, and that Detective Graziano and Assistant State's Attorney Nazarian committed perjury when they testified otherwise at the suppression hearing. And if he cannot make that clear and convincing showing, then he cannot show that any of the state court's determinations were unreasonable.
Unless we're unreasonable.
Pardon me?
Unless we turn out to be unreasonable.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm having
trouble. I said unless we turn out to be unreasonable.
Unless you turn out to be unreasonable, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Take the next step forward. That's your position.
Correct, Your Honor. And so if you look at what he put against this credibility determination, against the credible testimony of these two state witnesses, you have his own testimony, which the trial court specifically found not to be credible. You have a phone bill corroborating that he had called his attorney earlier in the day, but that, of course, alone is not enough to invoke Miranda. And you have an affidavit in which his attorney claims that he called the police station and told them not to interrogate his client. And as the court already noted, under Miranda, that's also not enough to invoke Miranda. Now, to be sure, this circumstantial evidence provides at least some suggestion that he was aware that it's a good idea to have an attorney, but he might have been aware of that in terms of wanting his attorney to bail him out of jail. This circumstantial evidence is at most indirect support for his claims, and it cannot outweigh the credible testimony of two state witnesses directly on the issue at stake. Accordingly, he cannot overcome the state court's factual findings, and the district court's judgment should be affirmed. I'll just touch briefly before I sit down on the two remaining arguments, one to touch on the state court's decision during post-conviction review. He claims the state court's post-conviction review decision was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts. It's a little difficult to pin down. He seems to be making one of two arguments, but neither of which has merit. One possible argument is that the state courts were unreasonable for failing to re-examine Miranda sua sponte during post-conviction review. As we point out in our brief, that claim is defaulted, forfeited, and meritless. His other claim that he seems to be hitting on in his reply brief is that the post-conviction appellate court unreasonably denied his ineffective assistance claim. For that, and specifically he seems to argue that his Miranda claim and ineffective assistance claim were so closely related that raising one was essentially raising the other. For that, it's enough to note that this court did not grant a certificate of appealability on an ineffective assistance claim, and he never moved to expand it. And in any case, ineffective assistance and Miranda are not the same claim. They're separate claims involving separate tests and separate provisions of the Constitution. And indeed, in this case, the state court denied him post-conviction relief because it found that he failed to show his lawyer's actions were not trial strategy. It had no need to reexamine the Miranda claim, and the state court was therefore not unreasonable for declining to do so. And then just finally, as we discuss in our brief, even if there were Miranda error in this case, it would be harmless under Brecht. The only argument that petitioner makes in response to this is he said, well, he might not have testified had his confession not been admitted. This sort of counterfactual argument, the argument that, well, had the confession not been admitted, then I wouldn't have testified. The easiest way to deal with this argument is to simply note that it's clearly forfeited. Under this court's opinion in Hinton versus Uckman at page 821, this court held that these sorts of counterfactual assertions must be argued in the opening brief, and if you raise them for the first time in the reply brief, then they're forfeited. And so, Your Honors, if this court has no further questions, then I would ask that the district court's judgment be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Mr. Michael, anything further?
2 minutes.
Yes, Your Honors. I have several brief points to raise on rebuttal. First, I'd like to remind this court that the appellant's argument is not relying on simply on overturning a credibility determination. It's arguing that when reviewing the decision of the trial court, the Illinois appellate court did not look at all the factors Coleman presented under the totality of the circumstances. Again, it's undisputed that simply an attorney calling is not going to invoke that right. However, this situation needs to be looked at under the totality of all the circumstances, starting from Coleman calling his attorney all the way through to his court-reported statement. Looking at those circumstances, the totality should indicate that he did in fact invoke his right to counsel, or at least did not voluntarily waive that right. As far as the harmless error argument, the Supreme Court has stated that the admission of a defendant's confession can almost never be harmless error. And here, where the evidence presented by the state was so minimal and so circumstantial, as the only real evidence they had was his statement against him. The only other evidence they had was that he placed a phone call and that he handed over some stray ammunition. Casings consistent with that ammunition, with those calibers, were found at the scene but never tied forensically to defendants. There's no way to know exactly where those items came from. Proving the voluntary waiver is a heavy burden on the state, and they did not make that. They did not meet that burden here. I'd like to remind this court again that at the time of this incident, Mr. Coleman was a young father who was doing much of and taking significant efforts to disassociate himself from Chicago gang life. He has now spent nearly 14 years in prison, with the state courts never having reasonably determined if he actually did invoke his right to counsel before giving his court-reported statement. For those foregoing reasons, I respectfully ask this court to reverse the decision and remand with instructions to grant Coleman's petition for habeas corpus relief unless the state elects to retry him without the benefit of his court-reported statement. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Michael, and we thank Notre Dame for the pro bono representation of Coleman, and we also thank Mr. Simpson.